Right now, we welcome to the program David Murata, the president of Murata Wealth Management. He's online at muratahonmoney.com. And today's topic, when is the best time to invest? David Murata, welcome back to The Shilling Show. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So I want to talk about the concept of market timing, just if people have heard the term, but they don't really understand what that is. And then we're going to dig into some of these details here. So what is that when people say, I'm going to time the market?
Yeah, I've had the opportunity being in the field that I'm in to watch a lot of families and to see sort of investor sentiments and the rules that they use. And market timing is basically waiting because of what you think is going on in the markets to either invest or to get out of investments or to move in and out of the markets because you're worried about what the market has just done in the recent future. So it's a little bit like trying to drive your car to your destination by looking in the rearview mirror. It's a very difficult thing to do. And yet most investors and most of us are wired, even maybe just by the way that our brains work, to want to do that. So whatever happened in the past is our indicator. And it doesn't matter. Some people, if the past was good, now they don't want to invest because now the markets are at all-time highs. And if the past was bad, well, now the markets are going down. It's always put in the present tense, and they don't want to invest because the markets are going down and they're afraid they'll continue to go down. And so what I've just done is I've been able to see enough families and also just to look at the markets themselves to see how those attitudes tend to sink us in meeting our financial goals.
You know, it seems to me there is some sort of disclaimer sometimes when they're talking about investments and advertising that past performance is not an indicator of, you know, future returns or language to that extent. So, I mean, I understand why people want to understand what happened in the past, but to base your future actions on what's already taken place doesn't seem like that necessarily makes sense.
And actually, that disclaimer that many mutual fund companies and investment people use is actually one of the things that misleads us, because the disclaimer is usually past performance is no guarantee of future returns. Mm-hmm. But it leaves the idea that although it's no guarantee, it's certainly an indicator. And actually, it's been proposed that there be a different disclaimer, and the different disclaimer is past performance has absolutely nothing to do with future returns, and in fact, it often moves contrary to the past performance and does the exact opposite, and so it's really not a good thing to use at all in terms of judging a mutual fund or a product or something like that. And in fact, the products that have done well in the last 5 years are liable to be the ones that do worse in the next 5 years or 10 years or whatever indicator, because there's a reversion to the mean where the things that weren't doing well now actually have a more attractive, you know, price per earnings. And the things that did well have now moved too far because of people piling on to a good investment, and they're liable to do poor going forward.
You know, that disclaimer change that you reference, I want to ask you about that, because it kind of reminds me of what they did with cigarettes. You know, they used to have kind of a mild warning on them,
yes.
And then all of a sudden they're like, you know, cigarettes will kill you dead or whatever you get on the pack of cigarettes today. Is that an industry-driven change, or is that something the government is insisting on as far as changing the language?
No, that actually has been proposed by a number of different writers and authors. Mm-hmm. who look at that disclaimer, and I think the disclaimer is put on. Usually, it's put on by a product, some mutual fund or something like that, which has done really well in the last 5 years, and they put it on to say it's no guarantee, but they put it on for the purpose of saying, but even though it's no guarantee, we're showing you our last 5 or 10 year performance. We're showing you how we have 5 Morningstar stars and how we've beaten our indexes and stuff like that, because we think shows you how wonderful we are. And then they put that on because it's a legal disclaimer, not because it's an actual disclaimer that helps investors.
There is, at this time, we've got just a couple minutes coming up to the break here. There are people who just desire to stay out of the markets. I've heard people talking about it in national media, and certainly no friends and others, acquaintances, who just don't want to get involved at all. Is that because of volatility? I'm guessing that would be the main reason. They're scared of losing money.
Yeah, most people are scared of losing money, and there's an article on our website. The American Association of Independent Investors has been around a long time, and its founder wrote an article recently, because he's kind of stepping down from the chair of that, and mm-hmm. he's been around for decades and decades. And he talked about his greatest regret, and he wrote, "Perhaps my greatest regret is not being able to convince as many investors as possible of what I feel is the most important lesson I've learned over the years. Real risk is the likelihood of not having the assets saved when you need them. Phantom risk is volatility that has little impact on the long-term investor." And I think that's probably the thing that I would say to most people is, if you're not invested in the markets, you will have to save a ton more money in order to fulfill your financial goals. If you're invested in the markets, and even if you just make something like 7% a year, you double the money that you have invested every decade. And that doubling effect means that if it's from your 20s to your 30s, it goes from, you know, 1 to 2. And then for your 40s, it goes to 4. And then in your 50s, it goes to 8. And in your 60s, it goes to 16. And that doubling and compounding effect is really the genius behind investing in the markets. You literally have millions of people in thousands of publicly traded companies who are working on your behalf and paying you a share of the earnings.
And that's what I think a lot of people don't understand. And maybe this goes back to the conversation we were having at the beginning of the program about financial literacy. I mean, it's got to be hard to convince people of something like that if they've never had, we've got about 30 seconds here, but if they've never had good training in understanding economics and finance.
Yeah, and it takes time in the markets to sort of see that effect. We really recommend that the minute your teenager has any earned income, you put that into a Roth IRA, because the tax they pay will be zero. Then they'll never be taxed on that ever again in their life. And if you start at 13 or 14 by investing in the markets, by the time you're 21 and you actually have a salary, you've already seen almost 7 or 8 years in investing. And you know, over those 7 and 8 years, the likelihood of the markets being up is very, very high.
We continue with David Murad on the other side. When is the best time to invest? And we'll get into your calls and questions as well. Challenges, 434-977-1070. The Shilling Show back right after news and weather updates here at the bottom of the hour. Hey, the Shilling Show continues on a Turbo Tuesday edition. David Murata is here with us, the president of Murata Wealth Management, online at muratonmoney.com. We're talking about the best time to invest. And Gary writes in via email, robs@wina.com. What investment advice do you have for new grandparents that would like to do something long-term for a grandchild?
That's a great question. And there's a number of ways that you can help a young person. We have at our firm, for our clients, we have millions of dollars invested in the Virginia College 529 accounts. And we have a whole sort of program we can help people with for that. And that's a great thing. Almost all of that money, not all, but almost all is owned by grandparents, mm-hmm. because grandparents know they have excess. And if you're going to fund either your children's education or your own retirement, we recommend that you put on your own mask first, if you will, and that you fund your own retirement. And until you know your retirement is secure, you don't necessarily help at funding your children's education, because they will lend you money for an education, even though we think that's a terrible thing, but they will not lend you money for your retirement. And so it's the more important of the two issues, the more eminent, if you will. So for a grandparent, you can help with college education. My wife and I have one granddaughter, and we've been helping to fund her 529 account. And I think that's a great gift to give to your grandchildren, is being able to graduate from college debt-free. If your grandchildren are older, and by older, I mean they have any earned income, dog walking, paper routes, mowing lawns, whatever, if they have any earned income, then we recommend that you offer to help them fund their Roth accounts. So if a child, say, has $300 from dog walking in a year, so long as they have that income reported, they'll probably pay no tax, because $300 is not enough to owe any tax. They may not even have to file if it's mm-hmm. if it's low enough, but they can fund their Roth IRA. But they have this $300, and $300 is a lot for them to have to be able to spend. So what you can do is you can offer to match. You will gift them $300 if they will put $300 into a Roth account. That way they can have their money and a Roth account too, because you're helping to match them in their savings. And so that means anytime they earn money, they can put it into a Roth, and they'll get that gift from you, and they can spend one half and they can invest the other half. Investing in a Roth account is amazing. If you put a few thousand dollars into a Roth account, it may grow to millions of dollars, ultimately for by the time they're 65. And that time in the markets will teach them multiple lessons. One, it will teach them to earn money and have a work ethic for what it takes to earn money. And then second, it will teach them about investing. And there's really three things that young people need to know. They need to know how to spend money, meaning how to shop wisely and to not do impulse mm-hmm. shopping. They need to know how to earn money because they need to know how to have a vocation. And they need to know about saving and investing, not just saving. Saving and putting the money in your sock drawer is fine, but if you put the money into your sock drawer, it's not going to fund your retirement. If you put the money in investments, it's liable to. And one way to think about that is if we have a working career from 25 to 65, that's 40 years working. If we have a retirement career from 65 to 95, that's 30 years retired. If you could only fund your retirement with cash, you're working for 40 years, you're spending it for 30, you have to save almost half of your value just to have enough for when inflation kicks around and you're spending it in retirement. So if you're not investing, you really do have to save a ton more money. If you're investing during that same time period, we recommend that you save 15% rather than 50%, because saving 15% will have the compounding effect such that you will be able to support your retirement.
Gary, thank you very much. I guess the plan B would just be to vote for the people who say we're going to provide for you whether you want to work or not. We'll give you a guaranteed basic income and just rely on the government and everything will be fine. So I guess you could go down one path or the other.
We do teach our children very strange sort of messages with what's going on in government.
Yeah, good grief. All right. 977-1070 is the phone number if you have comments or questions. We're talking about the best time to invest. Okay, so there's another theory called buying on the dips. In other words, I'm just going to kind of look for this little dip in the market, then I'll jump in and then jump out at other times. Is that how it works?
Yeah, buying on the dips really became popular during the bull market of the 1990s, because during the bull market of the 1990s, anytime the stock market went down by over 10%, even 5%, it was a buying opportunity because it was going to continue to go back up. And in the 1990s, there was only one that came close to a bear market, and it was only around for a few weeks, and then it was back up again, setting new highs. So buying on the dips is a vague idea, and so getting it concrete is difficult. I've looked at how far does it have to dip, and then how long do you have to invest, and how long do you measure whether or not it goes up or not. And I've looked at them all, and there's really no science behind it. The most popular one is the idea that if it's been down the last week, then that's a good time to invest. And I looked at that, and it turns out the average weekly rise is about 0.17% just mm-hmm. every week. That's the average weekly rise. But after a negative week, the average return is 0.23%. So it is higher. And after a positive week, the next week is on average about 0.12%. So the reason it is true that after a down week, the next week is liable to be up more. But after an up week, the next week is liable to be up anyway. Mm-hmm. So if you wait 8 weeks and the market continues to go up, on average, the market's going to be going up 0.12 and you'll lose an entire percent. So for every 8 weeks you delay, you've lost a percent. And if the market goes down, then it's more likely to go up the next week. So really, buy on dips is the correct philosophy only because of the first word, buy. Okay. And it's always a good idea to be invested in the markets. No matter what the markets have done, they have a just as good a chance of going up or down, going forward. Until the PE ratios get really, really crazy, you probably have a good chance of making money in the market. And by the PE ratios being really, really crazy, I mean the 30s or so. When the average is 14 to 16, if it's 35 in the markets, then you're probably at the height of the tech boom and tech bust and on the verge of the tech bust. And so that's probably not a great time to be invested in technology. And during the 1990s, people thought maybe the PE ratio was going to rise to 100 and that would be our new average. And that's just not true. That didn't happen. But at any rate, it's always a good time to be invested, whether the markets have gone up or the markets have gone down. And really, as I said, investors who sit and wait for 8 weeks and eight weeks for a dip in the markets, lose a percent. If you don't invest after a dip in the markets because you feel like the markets are going down, that's even worse. Mm. So if the markets are up, invest. And if the markets are down, definitely invest because they're liable to be up more the next week.
David Murata is our guest. 434-977-1070 is a phone number. We have one more segment left on when is the best time to invest. And we come back on the other side. I want to talk about the danger of inflation. Stay with us. Hey, the Shilling Show continues with David Murata, 434-977-1070. Email to robs@wina.com. All right, I want to talk about inflation. It really hasn't been in the news because, at least compared to the sort of inflation we saw back in the 70s, when they had those whip inflation now buttons, the win buttons, and even the into the early 80s when interest rates were so high. It hasn't been like that for a while, and so a lot of people don't even think about it, but we should be, right?
Yeah, and inflation did hit as high as 16% in the United States for a brief period and was a tremendous danger, if you will, in the 1970s. Inflation is currently averaged during 2018, during last year, inflation averaged 2.44%, which is very small and moderate. The average inflation over United States history is 4.1%. Mm. But 2.44 is very small. People are worried about investing in the markets because they're worried about a bear market. A bear market is when the stock market is down over 20%. But here's a prediction that I think I can stand by. We will have a bear market in cash over the next decade. And the reason why I know this is because if inflation is just averaging 2.44% each year, it will go down over the next decade. Your cash will lose 21.4% of its value.
That's a lot.
Yeah, that is a lot. And over the next, 35 years, if you're in retirement, it will lose 57% of its value. And that's with just a modest inflation of 2.44%. If we get, 3 or 4%, it loses close to 78% of its value over the same 35-year period. So inflation is the real danger. It's the real worry. And that is, I think, the thing that drives in investments. Investments, stock market on average makes 6.5% over inflation. So if inflation is running at 2.4 and it's going to make 6.5 on average, there's your 8.9% in the markets that would be my expectation of what the stock market would do. If it gets as high as 4.1% again, that's where you get, the 10 point something for the stock market, is because the stock market goes up by inflation plus something because it's doing real work and it has real value. And the real value and measured in dollars will simply go up by inflation on average plus the real work that's being done.
You mentioned inflation, and we've had the conversation before, but I'd like to revisit it just briefly, is that there's a lot of games being played with inflation by the government and how it's reported and how they take certain things into consideration and other things they don't. And so it seems to me that it's probably higher than what they're saying if we looked at it in a real world perspective.
Yeah, prior to 1996 or 1994, the way that inflation was measured by the government was different, and they changed how inflation is measured. And you can get into different arguments of how much that would under or over report if they did it the old way. My estimate is it's slightly over 1%, meaning if inflation is currently being reported at 2.44%, maybe it's 3.44%.
That's a significant percentage.
It is a significant percentage. And the games they play, you can say they're right or accurate, or you can say they're wrong, but here's one example. They have what's called the hedonic deprecator that they now use. And what it means is you're getting more fun out of the dollars, so therefore we're not going to inflate the dollars. And they use this, for example, for electronics. If an electronic item does more and costs less now, the fact that it does more means you could buy that old 1980s computer for really cheap. In fact, you can wear it on your watch. So now the fact that it does more, even if it costs the same price, means that they call it deflation, because it's more fun for the same dollars, and they actually count it as deflation. So what it does is it leaves people who are on fixed income like Social Security, it leaves them living Amish lives in a digital age because they can't afford this new fun stuff now because their Social Security didn't go up by enough to continue to buy it. And that's just one example. Another one is, creative substitution. That's another phrase they throw out. And what that means is if the price of pork goes up, you don't really buy as much pork. So then it shouldn't count for as much in the average senior's diet, because they'll buy chicken or beef. And if the price of beef goes up, then they'll buy chicken. And so they keep moving around how much they're buying of each thing based upon which one is the cheapest, which leaves them buying whichever meat is the cheapest rather than being able to buy what they want to buy. So, they count that as a deflationary effect as well. And all of these games, are economics games, and they're done, and both parties like them. The Democrats like them because it saves the money, and the Republicans like it because it saves the money. And so in both cases, it saves the government money. But in fact, since 1996, you know, that's been now, you know, 20 years. And 20 years of losing 1% in inflation means that seniors are probably living off 20% of what they had 2 decades ago, because the effect of that inflation not being measured and not being counted as part of Social Security is really severe. We recommend that if you're a young person, you just don't count on Social Security, because at some point it will probably be means tested, and you will probably, if you have any kind of savings, you will probably be means tested and disqualified from receiving any Social Security. But for people who are actually living off of it, they currently have a 20%, you know, cut in their lifestyle, simply because they lived over the 2 decades in which we were playing games within how we measure inflation.
We've got just a few minutes left, but I think this topic of inflation is important because a lot of people think inflation is something that just happens. Like, oh, we have some inflation here. It's like a storm blowing in. What is the cause of inflation? What prompts us to have that?
Yeah, so the cause of inflation is simply more money in the money supply than we have increased goods in society. But the incentive behind inflation is really our debt. We've got a tremendous debt in the United States, but if we can deflate the dollar, then we can pay it back easier because we're taxing more dollars then, and we're able to pay it back. So inflation is the friend of those who are trying to handle the deficit, because as long as you increase inflation faster than you increase the deficit, we're actually reducing the deficit because now all the dollars are cheaper. The danger of that is that we go the way of Zimbabwe and we have, you know, $100 trillion bills that we're trying to buy our groceries with. In our firm, pretty much most of our staff have $100 trillion Zimbabwe dollars. As a reminder that inflation is one of the greatest debts and dangers that we have to our retirement, and keeping money invested is really important.
So why is it that we haven't gotten there yet? Because my goodness, if you look at the explosion of debt, even over the past couple of years, you know, that what is it now, $20, $21 trillion? When is this going to catch up to us?
Yeah, we tried to have, the Fed has been trying to increase deflation. The truth of the matter is that you can have a tremendous debt, and so long as the debt isn't called, it isn't owed, and the interest rate on it doesn't rise too much, then it you can handle it. Japan is probably the worst country. They've got about 250% of their GDP in debt, and it's approaching now 300%. The emerging markets don't have an equivalent of the Fed, and their debt to GDP ratio is between 40% and 60%. It actually makes emerging markets debt a better and safer one at this point.
We should, before we finish up our time together today, answer the question, provide the punchline to when is the best time to invest?
Yeah, and the summary would really be a single word, and that is now. Especially for young people, they need to be saving and investing. And back to the AAI founder's greatest regrets. He said, because of the compound returns, the young have the most to gain from effective investing, but our membership age continues to average in the low 60s, and that was one of his regrets. They tried all kinds of things to do financial planning and investment for the young and non-affluent. They tried all kinds of discounts and promotions and encouragement and campaigns to increase the young and non-affluent, and they couldn't seem to do it. The young... there was a meme going around a while because one of the other financial blogs had by age 35 you should have at least twice your annual salary saved, and there was people thought that was absolutely ridiculous. So there was a meme going around by age 35, and then you should be Superman or you should have gone to the moon or stuff like that. The truth is, by age 35 you actually should have at least twice. Well, our estimates recommend you should have about 2.6 times. Your annual salary or your annual lifestyle saved. And that really just is starting at age 23 and saving 15% of your take-home pay each year. That's what you should have saved. That will put you on track to retire by age 65. If you wait till age 35 to start saving for your retirement, instead of 15%, you should save about 31.4% because you're late getting started. So for anyone who's listening to this, radio broadcast who's younger than age 35, really, you should start saving now, and you should start saving as significantly as you possibly can.
And you should remember the fable of the tortoise and the hare. Does anyone teach that anymore?
No, but the tortoise, slow and steady, wins the race.
That's right. David Murata, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
He's online at muratamoney.com.